is a quid? Hello, hello, hello. This is Pat Lynch, and joining me is
Kieran O'Keefe
and
Brendan Connell.
And way back there in the rafters, in the dark, we have
Dr. Shulga.
Yeah, Shulga and producer Jason.
Producer Jason, yes, we have we got a special guest star. This is a day of stars. So Radek is here to kind of just give us random takes on all things political as we cover, like, what we do all the time.
I actually want to see the show from this side of the computer.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Impressed with the star quality. But we have a few things we wanted to talk about. We had called like an off cycle election. And so we could talk that. We had the end of the shutdown, so we can talk that. And then we have, is the prediction markets, a.k.a. gambling, become the new poll, the way of political polling? So those seem like three things. Is there anything else that we should cover?
Were we going to talk about the filibuster, too? Was that in the prior email?
It was going to be the filibuster until, I think, once the Democrats caved in. Whoops.
They're kind of related anyway.
Yeah.
We can tie
yeah.
that into the discussion.
Yeah, throw it in. So thoughts as far as the election, Kieran, that took place?
Well, I think it went about as well as it could for Democrats under the circumstances. Not surprising, as I was saying before the show, any election that is sort of like an off-year election or even the midterms tends to favor Democrats because Democrats have become the party of really college-educated elites in some ways, and Republicans have become much more of a blue-collar, working-class party, and so that tends to benefit Democrats. If you've been looking, Trump's approval rating has always been very static, but if you follow it closely, it has been trending downward the last, let's say, 6 weeks or so, which probably didn't help. And what was most surprising is not the Democrats won, but I would say the margin by which they won. That surprised me a little bit. A lot of the polling in New Jersey, for example, had Sherrill up by maybe like 5-6 points, somewhere in that ballpark. And she won by around 15. And then Spanberger had a little bit more of a lead in the polls, but ended up winning an even bigger margin. Democrats picked up, I want to say, 13 seats in the Virginia Assembly, which is going to be important for them because they're looking to gerrymander their districts and try to erase three Republican districts and try to counteract what other, what Republican states are doing. And Virginia was, it's not really a deep blue state. It's more like a light blue state, I would say. Right. So they had to get some more seats to make that possible and obviously get a Democratic governor because they actually have a Republican governor right now, Glenn Youngkin. So those went very well. I don't know how much you can read into it because the electorate next year is going to be a little bit different. New Jersey and Virginia, too, are also states that Harris won. I mean, Trump actually did pretty well in New Jersey.
He improved.
He only lost by like 5 or 6 points in New Jersey, which is surprising given historical precedent. But I think Democrats would be cautiously optimistic. And we'll talk about the betting markets later on. But the betting markets now have had Democrats had a better chance of winning the House. So it was about like 54-55% in most markets prior to the election. Now it's up to 70, and that's in part because of what Virginia is going to do or try to do and what California approved, which was Prop 50, by which they're going to be able to try to erase 5 Republican seats among California's congressional districts.
Well, how about you, Brendan?
I don't have much to add.
We didn't talk New York.
Mamdani.
Yeah.
I was excited about that. Yeah. I am a Mamdani fan, but for the congressional elections, I mean, it's not uncommon for midterm loss to happen. So that's probably what's going to happen a year from now is the minority party tends to pick up seats. It's almost like predicting the sun's going to go down or come up. You know,
one year from now, how will people be looking at Mamdani and how he's running New York? What do you think? Because you're Long Island, so that's not that.
I'm also familiar with the ineptitude of the past few mayors.
Right.
I was not a fan of de Blasio.
And, right.
I'm not a Cuomo fan. Definitely not an Eric Adams fan.
Yeah.
So, like, at the very least, I'm excited to have someone that's not over the age of, like, 50.
Right.
And then also, I really don't think Mamdani is bought yet by special interests. Right. Maybe that will change.
Mm-hmm.
But he has like truly progressive policies, and he's the exact type of person. I guess he can't run for the presidency, but he's the exact type of person the Democrats right. should do in 2028.
Yeah.
Is like a young, charismatic person that is a populist of sorts from the left. That's what I would do.
Well, New York has AOC. Would she fit that bill?
Well, she came out with the dress one time, tax the rich. She's got that aura to her. But
and the Green New Deal was another thing that kind of didn't go anywhere.
But. Yeah. Yeah. I would also not, just knowing what I know about public opinion, I would also not run a woman again in 2028 to be
safe. Oh, that's almost a certainty. Yeah. I bet in the betting market. Yeah, go to, we'll talk betting. Yeah, we're going to talk betting markets, but yeah, there's... It's tried and failed, and they got Trump elected twice, you know, just trying to put a female candidate. Yeah. It's going to be, you know, I've heard like it's getting ultra specific. It's going to be a male, white male, 6'2", you know, yeah. No, seriously, you know, just a, you know, deep voice, you know, kind of out of central casting, you know.
What age?
What?
Do they have an age prediction?
It's going to be like 50. Early 50-ish.
People are tired of old guys. So.
Why are you looking at me by the standards?
Well, the betting markets have AOC number two right now in terms of likelihood of being the nominee. Gavin Newsom. Gavin Newsom is by far number one.
And see, he checks all the above boxes. So,
I mean, the thing with Newsom, though, is he has California strapped around him. And California, I think if you just ask the average American, what do you think of the governance of California, you're not going to get a very positive answer. So that's the risk.
A state you don't need to win because you know you're going to win it at the Democrat. So, like...
Yeah, I think like the homestead advantage has really worn down over the years. It used to be very important. I think today the homestead advantage it's not zero, but it's much less. Like I think if Andy Beshear wins the Democratic nomination, I don't think the Democrats are winning Kentucky. Now maybe you nominate like Josh Shapiro or somebody, you can win like an extra point or two in Pennsylvania. Maybe then that will make a difference. Which is actually back when Harris was thinking about who to pick as her VP. I kind of thought she should go with Shapiro just because of how important Pennsylvania was.
Right.
Mostly. Might have turned her down.
Yeah, I heard there was some like kerfluffle there between them. It sounds like they didn't maybe have a great exchange when there was in the vetting process.
See, I heard the opposite, that he was kind of a little bit of a show horse and might kind of try to take more of the spotlight versus, you know, the Walz that's, you know, more easygoing.
He's a white guy.
Well, I think, didn't she write that in her book? I think she said something along the lines in her book.
And I didn't know. Is that,
that he was like... I mean, I don't know. It's kind of an unfair criticism in some ways because you only have one side of the story. But like that when he was visiting her in the vice president's house in D.C., he was like, oh, this painting would look really good in my office.
Yeah.
That's what she wrote.
But. Yeah. It is, you know, that's, you know, that, and, you know, sometimes, you know, you got to be secure and, you know, and there's been tickets like JFK and Lyndon Johnson. I don't think they were best of friends, but it was a marriage of convenience. So. It all worked out.
But in that situation, you wanted like the kind of veteran kind of idea.
Yeah.
Too. I think that's why you picked Lyndon Johnson.
Yeah, it's trying to shore up Southern Democrat support as well. Yeah.
Now,
do you think if they run Newsom or AOC, they have any chance of winning?
I think they could nominate almost anybody and have a chance of winning just because of how like calcified the electorate is. I mean, it's going to be close, I think. We're in an era where you really can't blow out somebody else. So I think... I mean, maybe not literally anybody, but they could nominate most people and have a chance at winning. It's just a matter of who gives them the best chance. I don't think you're going to get an election like you had in, you know, the 80s where somebody wins 40 whatever states because you nominate a bad opponent.
The last blowout will be Obama, right?
If you consider 2008 a blowout, he won like 365 electoral votes or something.
He won very fast. That's the point.
Yeah. But AOC, I think she's just still too polarizing, and Newsom, some of the baggage that he has, if you think about opposition research, is pretty tough because, you know, I mean, California had such a serious homeless problem, and they never really, you know, as a governor solved that. And then remembering COVID, when everybody in California was very strict on COVID and they severe lockdowns. And then the news came out about him and all his close friends having this exclusive dinner at the French Laundry up in Napa Valley. And here they are, wining and dining, no mask, you know, yeah. and all this, while everybody else is all having to be forced to stay at home. And that, yeah, there's just, I just keep coming back to that. If I can remember those things, I'm sure that they're going to just, you know, when it comes to an election, it'll come out in force. Bashir, the Michael Bennett, the senator Colorado. From Colorado, yeah. You know, just people eat, maybe even Spanberger Pete. Oh man, I don't know if they no.
Is Harris still under the delusion that she's
yeah, she is. Yeah.
I think she'll throw her hat into the ring. I don't, my impression right now, and I could be wrong about this, is not a prediction, but my impression right now, based on the results of the 2024 election and what we've seen since, is the Democrats might be best served by going with somebody who is center-left on social issues and is an economic populist. That's my feeling behind it. But
is there anyone out there that fits that bill?
Dr. Connor.
Bernie Sanders. And I'll be of eligible age. Too old.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But see, I think there's... That's not the right lesson, because I think economic populism doesn't play on the same way on the left and right. So you can have the exact same idea, and if Republicans propose it, that's populism. But if a Democrat proposes it, that's socialism. And then that's a stigma. So like minimum wage, Republicans will vote for minimum wage in a state like Arkansas. But if a Democrat pushes for the minimum wage, then they're being socialist.
But you could look at the 2020 election where California refused to overturn affirmative action and Florida voted to raise minimum wage. So that's Florida votes Republican versus like a left-wing economic policy. California votes Democrat, endorses like a right-wing social policy.
But I think that kind of illustrates that the policies are not the key. That's not what people vote on.
Yeah.
Who presents the policy?
Yeah, I think they want to feel like you're fighting for them, and in some way, like I think making a boogeyman out of it is not maybe good in a vacuum, but it's sometimes necessary to win over voters. Like I think back to the 2016 election, I'm very hard to predict, but I kind of think of Bernie the nominee that he might have won, just because I think that sort of I'm fighting against the elites, you're getting screwed over. They would have branded him as a communist, but he had a certain message. I think that sort of populist message, it really resonated with a lot of people who weren't super ideological, who just kind of got an impression, get kind of a feeling about somebody. And this guy seems like he's fighting for you. He doesn't seem, he's not super far left on social issues as much. He's more like a center Democrat on that. But
I think, come from Vermont, you know, he's like, friendly with gun, as far as his view on, you know, guns was pretty moderate compared to a lot of Democrats. And and then, you know, he's a populist that's would have been going up against some quote-unquote billionaire from New York, which would have worked out really well.
Yeah, I remember in the 2016 Democratic primary, Hillary went after him from the left on gun control because being from Vermont, he had been a little more he wasn't conservative on it, but he had been more I think he had voted against some bill that would have allowed victims of gun violence to sue gun manufacturers, for example. And Hillary went after him about that.
There's a bit a hunting culture. It's, you know, in Vermont that that he respected and everything.
I just remember going back to like that primary, the states where you could have voters who were not in either party vote.
Right.
He did a lot better, and he tended to win over the independents who were voting in the primary. And the states where it was a closed primary, like in New York, he didn't do as well. It was just Democrats voting. And so I think there is something about, even though he's definitely pretty far to the left economically, I think there's something about like his messaging that resonated with a lot of Americans who otherwise weren't super engaged and sort of liked the feeling that he was fighting for them, that he was going after these big business elites. And if you can make them think that they're that you're on their side and you're going to take out the bad guys, if you will, I think that tends to motivate a lot of voters.
Well, you know, part of it, you know, going back to like kind of the whole thing around the recent elections is that, you know, in a way, you know, I think Democrats are making, they, I understand why they're making such a big deal about it, but I think it's not that big of a deal right now. It was blue, relatively blue states, you know, so they won by a bigger margin, but it was expected they were going to win. Mondami, goodness gracious, you know, his Republican opponent was Curtis Sliwa. Yeah, that was the best that they could come up with.
He always runs for it.
That's the best that they could come up with. And then Cuomo's just hanging around. I mean, it wasn't a landslide even there. I think he just won over 50%, didn't he? As far as as far as his total vote,
It's like 51%.
Yeah, and you know, like a guy like de Blasio or Adams, they were, you know, far greater than that. So it wasn't like, and always winners take claim mandates, and I'm mm-hmm. there to, you know, do this. And I think it's overblown. And then, you know, for any advantage that they thought they had, did they lose it completely when they caved on the shutdown? And kind of a interesting segue into the, you know, the next thing as far as you know, I did not see that coming, that they were going to have eight defectors. Yeah,
I got to run. So I wanted to just tell you what actually the Democrats should do to win the presidency. There's only one person that they should nominate.
Okay.
For him. It's Nick Saban.
Nick who?
Nick Saban.
Nick Saban.
Joe Manchin's friend.
run him as a Democrat. There's absolutely no way he could lose. Right, because all the Democrats will vote him because he's a Democrat.
Right.
And half the Republicans will vote for him because he's Nick Saban.
Yeah.
It's guaranteed. What else you got?
Maybe Alabama.
And he's actually politically very moderate. Kind of a big supporter.
But now it's the popularity contest.
Black Lives Matter when it started.
Yeah.
He led some marches. Like, he's a very reasonable guy.
He's like
an
opposite Jerry Jones.
He is, like, very good friends with Joe Manchin. They grew up, like, one town over from each other or something. He wrote the foreword to Joe Manchin's
former senator.
He grew up in West Virginia together.
Which perfect sense. So,
he was like a moderate Democrat.
But
right?
Could Nick Saban in the presidential? Could Nick Saban win Georgia? I have my doubts.
I think Auburn people will vote for Nick Saban. If Auburn people can vote for Nick Saban,
okay, the state of Georgia.
But, like, what is Nick Saban's policy in the Middle East? Like, is he really qualified? This is such a depressing thing now, U.S. politics. It's like, this is what it's come to, you know?
Don't hate the player, hate the game.
another person that was high up in the percentages for betting markets for being a nominee is Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
But see, that's been going on forever. And then there was, like, Stephen A. Smith.
He's up there too. Ooh, yeah, which okay. I'm not voting. I will not. If they're the general election nominee, I'd vote for them, but not primary.
I can't see The Rock, but I can totally see Nick Saban. Like, it just makes sense. It clicks for me.
But, you know,
and
like,
all you care is that he doesn't have to know about the Middle East. He just has to pick reasonable people who know about the Middle East for his cabinet.
That's right.
All I'm going to ask of a candidate is that he doesn't pick crazy people.
Nick Saban. All right. Well,
I got to go.
Put some money down. You got your early money on Nick Saban.
Actually, their odds are up there, and they're 50 to 1 for him to get the nomination.
It's not too bad.
All right.
So I'm really just trying to kind of get my stock to go up.
There you go. Yeah, he's trying to goose the market. But, you know, here, I did not see that. They, you know, day 40, day 41, and all of a sudden, Sunday night, here's eight, you know, Democrats, conveniently, none of them up for re-election, or they're leaving, and so they decided for the good of the nation, we're going to do, stop this, and on a promise of what, that sometime they may vote in the Senate, or extension of the ACA, you know, tax premiums, or the ACA premiums, and then what I think something about retroactive pay and stopping the all the forced firings, and that was about it.
Yeah, it wasn't. It surprised me a little bit because I thought after the good result last Tuesday, it might hold out a little bit longer. It sounds like, just from what I've heard, and who knows, reporting can change, but maybe this group of moderate Democrats wanted to do it earlier, and Schumer had them hold off for a while, and then just the tide got too big. Ultimately, the Democrats' biggest problem is they have very little leverage in this situation.
Yeah.
They can only get so much. I get why people are upset about it, but I don't know what the right decision is. I really don't. This is a hard thing it's very difficult to game out.
I mean, it's not a coincidence that they started canceling flights, right?
Right.
About a week ago, whatever it was. So, I mean, my guess is there were some offices that were getting angry phone calls from their voters. I admit, too, I was, like, hoping the government would end the shutdown because I want to go home and visit my parents for Thanksgiving. Yeah. And that's, you know, up in the air unless they're able to pass something, which they did.
Yeah.
And in that case, I think I was actually the stereotypical voter. I mean, people didn't care. It was actually shocking the first couple weeks.
Right.
People didn't care about the shutdown at all. It didn't seem because, like, unless you were a very significant or specific part of the population, your life really wasn't that affected initially. But then once it starts to sprawl out and once you start to realize how much the government matters and even things like air traffic control, then, you know, now people have skin in the game and and that's it. They want to call their congressperson and say, and, just,
you know, and some of it, when you get into like a contest, not a contest, but it's if you're going to choose battle, you know, you got to know what your enemy is capable of. And I think the Democrats just really didn't think that Trump and his administration would go to the lengths that they did to really cause pain. You know, so what, you know, SNAP, we're going to just cut, you know, like 1 out of 8 people who receive SNAP, benefits gone. Air traffic, you know, where they got to the controllers because they're stressed, and now all of a sudden you're cutting flights. They were just one by one inflicting. Even the early on, the layoffs, you know, it was like, okay, you're gone. Now here we're just going to start doing the, you know, just our whatever strategy they had and just letting people go. It's just, I don't know. Yeah, it's like kind of figure out what your enemy is going to do. And I don't think they really quite thought that through. And then they're painted into a corner because, no surprise, I think some of it was Thanksgiving coming around the corner with the combination of SNAP and canceled air flights that I don't know what else. Yeah, you know, and then they're trying to take the moral high ground and call this a win.
There wasn't a clear end game, like what was going to happen if Trump just said no, I'm not extending the subsidies, and then they were kind of stuck. I also suspect that some of those moderate Democrats were afraid of the filibuster, which we were talking about a little bit earlier, that possibly being removed, because if you go back to when Biden was president, his first the first Congress he had while he was president, where Democrats had a majority in both the House and the Senate, they had the trifecta. There were Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema were vocally against getting rid of the filibuster, to the chagrin of many Democrats. But I think privately there are many other Democrats who also did not want to get rid of the filibuster. And though Sinema and Manchin are gone, I think there are, you know, a number of institutional Democrats who do not want to see the filibuster go away, want to maintain it. And they were afraid that Trump, if it went on long enough, Trump would be able to convince the Republicans to get rid of it. And then that would, you know, really change the political dynamics in the country.
Yeah, because it's everything with Trump's a loyalty test. And so, he's for ending it. So are you part of us, or are you going to become our enemy? It's kind of pretty hard, you know, bare knuckle politics, but it seems to work.
Yeah, he's going to have a hard time convincing people like Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski to vote to get rid of the filibuster. But what do they have? They have 53 votes in the Senate, so he could afford 3 defections and still get it through. So who knows? I don't know what would have happened if it went on longer. And I think there's a real question about whether or not the filibuster is a good thing or whether or not we should have it. But there are still a lot of people in the Senate who want to have it.
Well, they got rid of it for Supreme Court justices, and look what happened there.
You know, that wasn't always around, though. You go back to, like, when Clarence Thomas was confirmed, for example, he only got, like, 52 votes or something. So they, like, it was existed at different points, but it wasn't always a thing.
Can we get a tally in the room of who wants to keep the filibuster and who wants to get rid of it?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. You go. I want to keep it.
Yeah.
I'm just curious if we disagree.
I don't know how I feel about it. I feel conflicted about it. I sort of get both sides. This is an issue I don't have a strong opinion on. So on the side that we should have a filibuster, ideally you do want some level of consensus when you pass legislation. You do want to not just sort of ram things down the throat of the country. You want to have like a public that's broadly accepting of it. The Senate is designed to be, as sometimes is termed, like the slow saucers are the term they
cooling,
use.
Cooling the saucer,
whatever. Yeah, this is something with saucer. I've heard the expression before. I can't remember it off the top of my head, but
cool the passions of the people or something.
Right.
Yeah, it's like slow things down. Yeah. The House is more reactive. The Senate's more House is more active. The Senate is more reactive in a way. Just kind of slow things down a little bit. So I get that argument. On the other hand, just the way the political dynamics work right now is from the perspective of the Democrats, they are never getting 60 votes in the Senate. There is no scenario which the way the priorities are currently constructed, the Democrats will, there's no scenario getting more than like 55 seats, even the best case scenario. Just, it will not happen. And there is something to be said about a large minority holding up progress. The filibuster was used to block, you know, the civil rights movement at times in the country to stop anti-lynching legislation. This filibuster has been weaponized for some very pernicious reasons throughout its history, and has been weaponized by a large minority to block what was good policy at different points. So there's that argument against it. Another argument against it, I think you could say, is that there are so many carve-outs now. Is it really even like a full filibuster anymore? It's really only for, you know, I guess, certain types of legislation, but not like financial legislation, right? Because you have the reconciliation bills, and it's not for the courts anymore. And so it's really been watered down already. So do you want to keep it around as a watered down version of what it used to be? So I think there are arguments in favor and against it on, you know, both sides.
Yeah. See, I just really wish, really hope and pray it stays. And reasons is that I think if you end it, then full partisanship is just going to be on display, and what we'll have is just a whipsaw thing of government. One party comes in, they just do whatever dramatic set of changes they want that goes around and gets completely reversed when the next party comes in. And at least the Senate, is the way it's constructed, it can slow things down. You might not, you know, maybe accomplish as much. But I just think that it would just be this, you know, this country going back and forth, and you know, no matter what, we have a tendency of changing political parties, you know, at least every 8 years. So that, you know, that's kind of my fear.
It's interesting because I don't know how many other countries out there, and Brendan knows better than me, where you have to get 60% to pass legislation.
Right.
I think in most systems, it's probably just a bare majority.
Right.
And I think what might be a counterpoint to that is that it's true, you could have like a whiplash effect, but maybe also you can get some legislation through that is pretty popular that once it's actually in effect, people will like, and then they won't repeal it.
Yeah.
I think that would be another possible outcome of it.
Yeah.
Really, what was the last major piece of legislation we got through that was not in the reconciliation bill? I think it probably was the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
And that was like 15, 16 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's something that, I mean, maybe it would have been overturned if there wasn't a filibuster. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But still, it's something that was, you know, has become pretty popular over the years once you actually implemented it. And so something like, if there wasn't a filibuster, the Democrats would have passed an anti-gerrymandering bill when Biden is president. You get that out there. Are they really going to repeal that? You want to repeal an anti-gerrymandering bill? I mean, maybe. I don't know. It's possible.
But sure.
That'd be a very popular piece of legislation. And once you got it through, I think it'd be hard to root out, even if the Republicans won back the House and the Senate. So
yeah.
I don't have a strong opinion on this. I do think there are dangers if you got rid of it. But I don't think it's as clear. It's not totally clear to me that it would be beneficial to keep it either in the interest of the country as a whole.
But, you know, if somehow they'd gone and changed and made the filibuster go away, think about, you know, kind of what Republicans could do right now. Could they add judges to the Supreme Court? I guess, you know,
is that unconstitutional?
No, that's not set by the Constitution.
No. You know, so, you know, that would be one of the big things that I think they would definitely do, you know, just to kind of lock in that uber conservative majority.
Here's back to my question, yeah. Then. Why is it so important for us to have this supermajority to get legislation through, but it isn't important in other countries? I guess that's...
Because other countries aren't as well-run and big and beautiful as America.
Everything's bigger in America.
No, it's a good question. Now, Brendan, you have any...
I don't know of other countries that have something that resembles a filibuster, so it's got to be unique to the United States, I think.
Yeah.
What I'd say, though, is there is more of a spirit of maybe not building consensus, but cross-party cooperation right. If you go to Europe. And it's really just the nature of their multi-party systems.
You have to build coalitions.
Yeah, typically you're going to need to partner up with at least one other party to form a coalition or form a government. So it's already kind of built in to mm-hmm. the system, whereas in the United States, in a two-party system, by definition, right, there's always going to be a majority party that
right.
they have, you know, at least 50+1% of the votes, so they could just kind of pass whatever and impose their will on the minority. And that's why I kind of like the filibuster, is it's really a vital part of checks and balances. And if you look at how democracies backslide elsewhere, whether through history or just, you know, democracies out there nowadays that are going through trouble, how democracy implodes is just tweaking the checks and balances like bit by bit.
Right.
And then it just cascades into all of a sudden one day it's like, oh, we've had a president now for 20 years or something.
Sure.
So,
yeah.
So I could see that happening in the United States. That's why I would be reluctant to get rid of the filibuster. It is a trade-off though, right? So it's like, on the one hand, it is a part of limited government checks and balances. On the other hand, makes it harder to pass policies. That means it makes it harder to pass good policies at times too. But I think what I'd say back to that is, if you look at just the filibuster being used, it's like this spike over the past 10, 15 right. years. The filibuster has been around for a long time. It's not a constitutional thing, but it's been around for a long time, been around for centuries. It's only now become like a thing that's like frequently used to block legislation. I think the problem is not the filibuster. I think it's just polarization and just toxic politics nowadays.
Right.
So getting rid of the filibuster is not going to fix that problem.
Right.
It could actually make it worse.
Yeah.
So how do you fix polarization in this country? I have no freaking clue, but I would keep the filibuster nonetheless.
Karen, you were outvoted 2-1. So
I wasn't voting to get rid of it. I was abstaining from it. I was in the middle. I don't know. If I was on the Senate, I don't know how I would vote. I really don't know. I can see arguments in favor and against.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of risks to getting rid of it.
Right.
I certainly see that.
And I have a question, too. How do you get rid of the filibuster? What would that look like?
Yeah, that is an interest. That was what I was going to bring up.
You need 50 Republicans to vote to get rid of it.
So you can't filibuster getting rid of the filibuster?
No.
Yeah.
No, you can't do that. So
okay.
I'd be 50 Republicans, then Vance comes in, breaks the tie, and then get rid of it. That's what happened, was it back in, it was when Gorsuch was nominated
for, right.
It was 60 votes, and then McConnell said we're just going to have a simple majority to get rid of the 60-vote threshold, and that's what happened. So, I don't know.
And Harry Reid in, I think it was 2013 or somewhere, was with lower level judges, right?
Yeah, he did the same thing.
Yeah.
After Obama lost control, or not even after the 2010 elections, they lost their 60 seats they had in the Senate.
Well, and McConnell he made a point of that he was going to do everything possible to just impede, you know, progress from Obama.
And that's the problem now is that that's sort of what everybody does. The Democrats would absolutely do the same exact thing if they had the ability right now.
Right.
And it's a product of the people who vote, at least in primaries.
Mm-hmm.
They are the ones, they want their party not to work in coalition building, but to work in obstruction.
Yeah.
And then we could talk about this sometimes, whether or not primaries are good for democracy. I think there's an argument that primaries are not good for democracy.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly because of what Raddick said about Nick Saban potentially becoming a candidate for the Democrats. Like, that doesn't happen
if we don't
have primaries.
But then what, do you go back to the smoke-filled room where a candidate's picked?
Yeah.
You're like old school, yeah.
I recognize the limits of democracy,
right?
And there could be too much of it.
Because primary, 1960? Is that what I'm thinking?
Yeah, late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah, I think.
I mean, primaries have been around, but it used to be back like before the modern system. Well, you'd go visit a few states. There'd be primaries in a few states, and you'd bring candidates would bring a certain number of delegates to the convention, and so somebody would have a head start, but they didn't win because they won New Hampshire or something. They came in with some delegates, but then you could vote for, you know, they're mostly unpledged delegates, and they could vote for
everybody's
whatever they wanted.
Everybody's undecided when they arrive at the convention center, and then you just kind of work. Everybody works the room, trying to drum up votes.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, there's again a lot of compromise, coalition building, but. If you have primaries, Donald Trump would not be a major political figure in the U.S. right now.
Right.
So he never would have won in 2016.
Right.
There's no way. It's another thing where I think if you look at other countries, and again, Brendan will know more about this than me, but there are a lot of other countries that don't have it set up the way we do because it's sort of this weird thing that empowers the most radical ideological people in the country to choose candidates who then are forced on a population who are less engaged, don't vote in primaries, but then are stuck choosing between people who have views that, you know, don't represent what they have for the most part.
Saban, 2028. Dramatic change of subject. Are prediction markets or gambling sites becoming the new political polling instruments? You know, I sent the article from that the New York Times had about Kalshi and Polymarket, two of the more prominent ones, about they're getting into basically letting people bet on all of these things. Like, well, going back to Nick Saban, he's 50-1 right now, and so you can bet on Kalshi. They even have an ad that it's like you can bet on literally anything. It's almost, I think, the copy from that. And now they're looking at is the betting market actually more accurate when it comes to predicting which candidate is going to win versus all the traditional means of political polling?
Yeah, I wonder. I would think that they're probably more accurate what they're probably very good at is when the results start coming in, they can just crunch the math. At some point, they can figure out, okay, this county has X number of ballots that haven't been cast, and this county has this many left to be counted, and sort of crunch the numbers and figure out who's going to win based on that. I don't know. Long term, I wonder if they are more accurate, just because they go through wild swings. If you watch them, they go through wild swings sometimes, and they can be affected by very little things, then go back down. I mean, it's like, I don't know, kind of the stock market, I guess, in a sense. They can swing pretty wildly. So whether or not they're more accurate, I don't know. I think there is a question whether or not they're good for the country. You've made the gamification of politics.
But can it skew? I remember just saying, what could possibly go wrong? And the prediction markets could be manipulated. And I think I don't know if this was completely accurate. Mamdani had I don't know if it was a billboard or social media post. It's like Mamdani 92. Cuomo 8 or something that, he kind of put, what the prediction markets were going to say. And he used that as an advertising message. And so will that, dissuade potential Cuomo voters? All is lost. Why bother? Why waste my time if he's going to lose? And can that kind of thing just all of a sudden really skew elections?
I'm less worried about that and more so I feel like someone's gonna get killed over this eventually. I mean this is a problem in sports right now too, is there's like ongoing scandals in basketball and UFC about this, but whenever you got people trying to make a quick buck and betting a lot of money. I mean,
yeah.
And you're betting on things that are not sports. It's like the political world where people potentially have conflicts of interest and they have influence on these things. Like, this seems like a terrible idea. I don't like the way our culture is going generally with betting. And it's not, we've talked about this in private, but it's not good for young people either. It's a weird time to be growing up.
Young men are the most like, they're the ones most attracted to this kind of thing. And so they're less risk averse. They're, you know, they're competitive, you know, it becomes a form of entertainment. And so that now they're just, you know, putting money into this thing. And I never thought of it as far as somebody getting hurt. Cause all of a sudden somebody's has a massive bet on one candidate and the candidate seems to be losing. Would that potentially be an assassination plot?
Or the other way around.
That's
like
frightening.
You're scared that the other candidate's going to win and you just go, oh, I'm going to, you know.
Yeah.
Kill him. Maybe. I think when it comes to sports, like, I've heard people say things like, oh, well, it's actually good it's all out in the open now because you'd be more regulated. I don't buy that because it's so like just omnipresent in society now. Betting ads everywhere. We cannot watch anything on TV, sports world, without being a million betting ads. And you can do it so easily. There's zero friction. I think there's something to be said about friction, something that slows you down, like the filibuster maybe, slows you down a little bit. As you go to bet, you have to go, like in the past, you had to go to a book, you had to go somewhere and do something.
Race
now
track,
you could just be laying in your bed, at, 11:37 at night on your phone, half asleep, and just place a bet on whatever. And there's just, without any friction in place, it leads, I think, to very bad outcomes. There's been a lot of scandals right now. The one that broke, two or three days ago was that two pitchers on the Cleveland Guardians, or actually my baseball team, were involved in prop bets. And what they were doing is, this is out, they were suspended back in June, July for this originally. But the federal prosecution, the indictment came out the other day and one of them was arrested. But they were, I guess there are prop bets on betting sites where you can bet on whether or not the pitch will be a ball or a strike and whether or not the pitch will exceed a certain velocity. And so these pitchers were just like intentionally throwing a ball on the first pitch, down 1-0 in the count, but then they'd have their friend bet, $10,000 or whatever on the prop bet. Or the velocity one, the friend's going to bet for, under 100 miles an hour, and then the pitcher throws a slider, which is 90 miles an hour, and so it's slower. So there's that. I just think you need some level of friction in place. This is like the argument where people say, guns aren't the problem. It's people. Okay, but if you put some like guardrails in place, you can limit the problem. If you're just having totally unregulated and wide open betting with zero friction, that's just advertised everywhere. And also, this is back to the pitchers thing, but I'm listening to a podcast about these pitchers being indicted for gambling, and then it's like this show is presented to you by FanDuel.
Oh yeah, of course, yeah.
It's like, I don't know, maybe get a different advertiser for this one, different sponsor for this episode. Yeah. So I'm just tired of it. It's so excessive. I wish the Supreme Court just hadn't overturned it back in 2018. It's caused so many problems.
My big thing is I feel like they just got to do like what they do with tobacco is you just got to get rid of the advertising. I think the advertising is like the big, I mean, of course it's in everybody's pocket now that's going to do it. But I think like the advertising is just so not only misleading, but it also just keeps inciting you for people who are trying to quit.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, well, I could get $500 in bonus bets. You know, why shouldn't I just put $10 in?
Sure.
You know, and people are addicted to it. And I think like, you got to just like do the tobacco route. Like the people who are going to do it are going to do it, you know, just like with tobacco. But at least you can kind of minimize, you know, and slowly take that, you know, cull the herd, as I say, like slowly bring it back to what it is or just overturn it. Because I think it was just kind of, it is, at what point does it just go, oh, we're making so much money from this. Why shouldn't we just bring back gambling?
You know? Yeah.
Because gambling makes so much money in tax revenue. Why shouldn't we make unlimited money, you know?
Yeah, I think it would be a good approach to take the tobacco route and limit the advertising because that is just, it's ridiculous. It's so over the top. And what, I don't know, like just, I'm not saying it's wrong to like place a few bucks down on this and that, but the people they're making money off of is not somebody who's gambling responsibly. They're making money off people who are not gambling responsibly, and who have no idea, or just like deluded into thinking they can beat the algorithms, and are placing crazy amounts of money on sporting events or political events, you know, whatever. It's not, I mean, it's not good for society in a lot of ways. It's a bad addictive habit to get into, at least any, and with any kind of regularity, I think. And it's just so advertised in a way that just makes it so easy. And again, the friction part of it has come back to, there's no friction. You need to put some friction in place.
2028 midterms will be heavily watched. So now are we going to, CNN in partnership with FanDuel and Polymarket, are they going to be running the odds like the, you do on Sunday with the NFL today, and you got, I mean, do you see that coming?
I think
No, really. Do you see that coming? Yeah.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, yeah. The more they can treat it like sports, the better. I mean, that's how you want to attract viewers, for sure.
Yeah, because they love, the whole competitive race. That's, they feed off of that. Yeah. That's why they love campaigns. Mm-hmm. Who's up, who's down, how much money did they collect?
Election night, it's always red versus blue. They got a guy on the map putting in colors.
With the magic board.
Can still win.
Got the magic board. And so, here it is. You know, just some.
This just great. In, Iowa's been declared.
Yeah.
And just add
somebody
votes.
Just drops to their knees.
Somebody just won, and here's what the payout was for
us.
One better put down.
I can't believe that is, okay. Kind of side note, because I feel like that could happen. I can't believe that they do that on national television for sports.
Yeah, yeah.
Like on the games, they're like, oh, here's my bet. You know, like Matt or, you know, somebody, Matt Ryan, whoever is like, oh, I'm going to, if you put in, I'm going to say, three rushing touchdowns from Saquon Barkley. It's like, oh, you could put in $5 and win X amount of money. I can't believe they can do that. Like that's
They're paid to do it. Too.
I know, also, like, why? First off, why are you taking betting advice from somebody on TV? Second off, I can't believe they're just doing that. I can't believe that's legal to do, because it is kind of just like. It's kind of like trying to, like,
probably part of the sponsorship.
It's like entrapment.
It's part of the sponsorship deal.
I feel like it is like some sort of entrapment, right? Like it is. Yeah. Like,
but we'll have to go and look at. Look at that, in 2028, will that...
I can see that.
I don't think, though, that the betting markets are going to be any more accurate than the polls. In fact, they might be worse.
Yeah.
I think in part what's happening is recency bias, just because the polls got it a little bit wrong for the past few elections. But I think there's a... People don't understand where the betting lines come from.
Mm-hmm.
They are set initially by experts, but otherwise they're market driven.
Right.
So it's the same. I wish Radek was here. It's like, what determines prices in markets? It's markets themselves. It's supply and demand, let's say. But like most of the time, the market's very good at getting the price right. But occasionally it's not, right? Yeah. There's like real estate bubbles. There's stock market
irrational
bubbles.
Irrational exuberance. Or
So you'd have the same thing for elections or betting on sports, where lines get out of whack because the market is led the wrong direction for whatever reason. So I think the betting markets will probably get it pretty right most of the time. But that's the case for polls as well. So... I wouldn't put too much stock in betting lines to predict.
They'll become the new
also,
political.
Like, we were talking about this earlier, but like the Kalshi, the reason why they got into like the betting that they're getting into now is because they were so egregiously scammy in the sports betting market that sports bettors were not interested in what they had to offer. And this thing kind of morphed into a whole new entity that is Kalshi, that now is doing like all these crazy bets. At what point does they kind of just give you fake numbers to incentivize you to bet, because I mean, it's regulated a little bit. Right. But I mean, what's to stop them if they're already a shady company and they got backroom deals, see that happening a lot too.
Well, speaking of shady, oh my goodness. It's been a while, and I had a thoughts about whether to do a 24/7 All Things Epstein podcast, but it came out, that I guess now there's some, smoking email, with Jeff writing to his bud, Donald, you know, and just new evidence. But wanted to share with you kind of a conspiracy theory that I have. Okay, and I got my conspiracy mojo amped up after our last podcast. But you need 218 votes in the House to release the Epstein files. They swore in the representative from Arizona, or they're going to. But I don't think they're ever going to get to 218. What is going to happen is there's going to be this closed door kind of political pressure campaign to try and always peel off votes. Lauren Boebert, Nancy Mace, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene. You want this in your district? You know, here's what we could do. And I don't know if they're ever going to reach 218 until the midterms where it changes the math somewhat. I mean, what do you guys think?
Well, they swore her in this afternoon, and she already signed the discharge petition. It's the first thing she did.
Oh, I read of course, that before
I
came
here. She signed the discharge petition. I think it has to sit now for 7 days or something before it can be brought up for a vote.
Yeah.
So then we'll see in the next 7 days if any Republicans are peeled off. So I don't know. I don't have any strong predictions about this.
We're going to force you on this one. You know, we pressured you on the filibuster, and you can't.
Well, some things are black and or gray instead of black and white. So this is one that I don't know. Predictions are hard, but I think there will certainly be pressure on Republicans to peel off from this by the Trump administration. They're already doing it. They met with Lauren Boebert, I think it was today.
Yep.
But I don't know. This whole thing, I still think the Epstein situation is probably, the files are probably going to be less exciting than Democrats want them to be. Like, whatever Trump's relationship with him, whatever he did, is probably more, I could be wrong, but could be. I'll make this prediction that if it all comes out, it'll probably be more boring than Democrats think it is. I think there are a lot of Democrats who like secretly want Trump to have been this pedophile, this sex abuser. I don't really want that. I don't want that to be my president. I mean, maybe he already is that. I don't know. He had the case with the woman a few years. I forget her name, the woman who sued him for rape in civil court.
E. Jean Carroll.
Or was it sexual assault or something? Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it wasn't rape. I forget what it was exactly. But anyway, I don't know. I still go back to that Biden was president for 4 years. The Epstein files were there. If it was so egregious, why didn't the Biden administration do something about it? Why didn't the DOJ do something about it then? Why is it under the Trump administration that's finally becoming even a bigger issue than it was then? And I think what's happened with Trump over the years is that Democrats have always tried to find a shortcut to beat him. If you go back to right after he was inaugurated, it was like, well, the Bob Mueller case, Mueller's going to take him down. Then it was like, remember Michael Avenatti for like 3 months was a huge star where it's like, he's going to take Trump down over Stormy Daniels. Yeah. And then there was the first impeachment, and there was a second impeachment, and then it's going to be the 14th Amendment to disbar him. It's just like there's always something. And I think ultimately Trump will only be defeated if you can beat him, you know, at the ballot box, which they did once and they didn't do it twice. I don't know. It just seems like another one of those shortcuts to try to beat Trump in a way and beat the Republicans without having to, I guess to help them with the ballot box, but to do it in the, because ultimately, like if they find more evidence and think Trump did something, this will eventually, if the Democrats control the House, result in impeachment, I think, in a couple of years. And then we'll have another impeachment case. But I think if the Democrats take the House, the chances of impeachment are pretty high.
You don't think he would resign if it came out he was like straight up just a pedophile?
No, I don't think Trump would ever resign.
No.
Oh, no.
Like, what if it was so bad that like the Republicans were down to impeach him? You think he would still stand on that and get impeached?
I mean, okay, yes. If he was going to be removed from office, then he might resign rather than being removed. But I don't think in the polarized environment, I think it'd come out that Trump is like the world's biggest pedophile. I'm not sure it would move enough Republican senators. Maybe it would. I don't know.
That was my fear, was like, I was telling Pat earlier, is it's like with the voter base, it's like they're going to be like, you know, it could say like, oh, you know, he went to the island or whatever, you know, and that's what it says. And then they're just like, well, he didn't do anything. You know, it's always like they're always going to find another step to try to make it seem less bad, you know, and the voters will eat it up.
They'll just deny it's real news.
Yeah.
Is
what I mean, that's the easiest one.
I always ask my students, they're like, have you ever tried to convince a flat earther that the earth is round? It's impossible to do.
Yeah.
You can't do it.
Yeah.
You have all the information you need, but you can't do it.
Well, where are you as far as, do you think that this vote will ever come about, or that they're going to just put a pressure campaign to avoid getting the 218?
I don't know. Maybe they'll move the filibuster to the House is another way to stop this from happening. But I guess I just kind of agree with Cure. And I'm also, I don't mean to sound cold, but I just never really cared that much about the Epstein files.
Yeah.
Like, I'm someone that I care about lowering healthcare costs. Like, why every time when I have to go to the doctor, I get a bill for like $500 for those basic things?
Yeah.
Can we figure out a way to have this go down even by 10%? It's like, I feel like there's just so many problems right now with our country.
Yeah.
I just don't care about the Epstein files.
Yeah.
So.
But yeah, it just preoccupies just so much time.
It captivates an audience is the strategy.
It's just entertainment, right? You know, like.
Right. Yeah. You got to get people. Yeah. But I also don't need the Epstein files to tell me what kind of person that Trump is.
Yeah.
So that's maybe another reason why I don't care.
Yeah, that's pretty baked in at this point.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a good time to kind of wrap this up. I thank you both. You know, it's always, that seems like forever since we're back in the studio, but it's only been 2 weeks.
A couple weeks, yeah.
Yeah, but but it was all good. And always, always, always have to thank our audience that listens and watches as the world turns or burns. We'll be back to you as always. We broadcast every other week, so just stick with us, subscribe, recommend us to friends, and we will catch up with you later. Take care.
This podcast is sponsored in part by Lion College and Kilt Studios. Thank you to Jonah Winter for the intro and outro music.
That they should nominate?
Okay.
It's Nick Saban.
Who?
Emeka Egbegbo.
No games, no fun.